We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's and this past year's news.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year to you both.
And it's got to be better, right?
Yeah. Sure. Or your money.
I mean, never say worse is enough to the challenge, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I hope you both and everybody listening had a nice, relaxing, quiet holiday weekend at home.
So I wanted a quick update on the station news. I didn't have a quiet one because we were moving equipment and furniture from the former studio space at University Temple, which as of today is officially locked up and beginning the demolition process. But the good news is we did find new studio space over at our friend's Jack Straw Cultural Center. So we moved a bunch of the stuff over there. It will take...
Oh, over on Roosevelt?
Yep. Just six blocks from our former location. So we're still in the U District. So we will be able to get some good news about our friends, like, for instance, at the Behemoth University of Washington. And that'll take about, who knows how long. It's going to take at least a month to rebuild the station there. We're still in the process of locating a new transmitter location, transmitter antenna location. So that's going to take probably close to a full year, I'm guessing. We shall see. But that was a great development, actually, finding out at the last minute that we actually did have a place to move to.
Yeah, so for now the...
Thank you, Jack Straw.
So yeah. What that means in practice is that for now the terrestrial signal is down, but people can still access our content streaming online.
You are correct. And still get the podcast from the usual places.
Yes, and I link to that on my social media every week, so.
There you have it. All right, so moving on to this week's news, and traditionally, as we started last week, you both do a wrap-up each year of the over-underreported stories, and we will be continuing that in just a moment. But before that, Jav wanted to note some interesting trends that are occurring with our weather.
Yeah, just to debunk some right-wing tropes, Seattle's weather for 2020, the National Weather Service put out its statistics at the end of the year yesterday, and Seattle's highs were 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit above average, and its lows were 2 full degrees above average. Now, that doesn't sound like a whole lot, but actually, in terms of climate change, it is. And that continues a trend that we've seen over the last decade. So, you know, we're being impacted by climate change here as well as, you know, pretty much everywhere. The rain total was nearly 4 inches above average last year. So we'll see if that continues. The modeling for climate change for Seattle, suggests that, we will be wetter here than we have been in the past as time goes on. So, as well as warmer. So, that's all holding to the trends. And, unfortunately, even though it was a very, very busy news year, climate change really didn't care. It keeps going.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, what these statistics tell us is one thing, but then what that means in reality, you know, people, you need to think about what our local ecosystem is like. For example, being much warmer and being wetter in the winter means that we'll have less snowpack in the mountains. And that means drier, you know, the rain doesn't come evenly over the year. It comes mostly in the fall and winter and early spring. So we're much drier in the summer. And when you're warmer and wetter in the winter, we see a lot more plant growth. And then if you're extremely dry in the summer and hot, then that means a higher fire risk.
And
in
also,
addition to more, you know, to more droughts because we lack the snowpack we usually have.
Yeah. And it also threatens the water supply for like 4 million people. So
yeah, exactly.
That's a concern as well.
Cause that's the main source of our water supply around here is our snowpack that we usually get in the winter or that we used to usually get in the winter. So those are very concerning shifts. In addition to what it means for the trees and plant life that we're used to having here that are adjusted to a colder and more evenly damp year. You know, we've seen it. We've seen the impact on some of our iconic tree species, which are starting to die off around here. It's very concerning.
I would also be interested in seeing the water temperature, say in Puget Sound, because that's going to affect marine life as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the news stories too this week was that sockeye returning from the ocean to our rivers are at an all-time low. We're at an all-time low this year, so that's telling you something about warmer water temperatures here in our rivers with the lack of a snowpack.
Also acidity of the salt water. I'm interested in hearing about that because that's certainly a problem in the oceans. Well, it's good to know that for the new year, we're continuing our trend of feel good news.
That remains consistent regardless of other conditions. So.
Yeah. True.
All right. Well, let's move on from that to this week's COVID updates.
Yeah, sure. Another feel good story. Jay Inslee extended restrictions that were due to expire at the end of the year in terms of things like indoor dining for another week. I'm sure that will be extended once again come the end of next week. And he extended eviction moratoriums until March 31st. Now, there's a huge caveat to that, which is that once those moratoriums are lifted, people who have not been able to keep up because we're in the midst of a depression that nobody's really talking about, they're still going to owe all that money, probably with interest in a lot of cases. So unless you've got an extremely benevolent landlord and can make arrangements, you still need to be trying to either, pay the rent or sock away the money to be able to pay the rent. And that's going to be very, very difficult for a lot of people when that moratorium is lifted, unless there's a massive infusion of federal and state money to help people meet those bills.
Yeah, or unless there's some kind of a program for rent and mortgage forgiveness. Because a lot of landlords are going to go, oh, God, Maria, no, I have bills to pay. But the main bill that they have to pay generally is the mortgage. So if there's some kind of program that can forgive mortgage payments, that would be very helpful for people who have been out of work or landlords whose tenants have not been able to pay.
And we'll talk about this in a little bit, but, newsflash, $600 is not going to help people meet those bills.
No.
We're going to see some serious economic pain in 2021, I think.
Okay. And then Washington State announced that they were going to launch a COVID-19 vaccine tool called...
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, there's been a lot of confusion about who is eligible to get the COVID-19 vaccine and when. And a lot of people asking, which phase am I in? Am I phase 2? Am I phase 3? Am I phase 4? But, also doctors are asking this and employers. And so the Washington State Health Department said that they were going to launch a vaccine tool called PhaseFinder, where you would go online and answer some questions in a questionnaire and then either print a copy of that or take a screenshot of the questionnaire with your answers filled in and take it to your local pharmacy or doctor's office to get the vaccine. It will also tell you, of course, whether now is the time for you to go or whether you need to wait for the next phase. Washington will also provide a template letter for employers to give to their employees to vouch for the eligibility of their workers or certain workers to get the vaccine when they need it. The questions are going to ask things about age, occupation, pre-existing medical conditions, a person's living situation, and your zip code. There may be other questions, too. The tool's going to be available in multiple languages, but as I'm sure Jav identified immediately, it won't be easily accessible to everyone, especially elderly people, homeless people, and those without stable internet access. Or even, people who are disabled and not able to easily read things online. And of course, the answers to the questions are going to be taken on faith. So it's going to be based on self-reporting, and we'll expect that there are some people who are going to lie in order to get the vaccine sooner than they really need it. And of course, while no one wants to be the vaccine police, and medical care professionals shouldn't have to do that, there's the issue of, well, you know, in fairness, how do we ensure that only the people who are in, you know, line to get it actually get it, and not the people who are cutting the line?
But we're seeing that in a lot of parts of the country where jurisdictions are relying on people's self-reporting because health departments just don't have the personnel to police that kind of thing. They're not being given any kind of resources by the federal government to help in the vaccine rollout. And we've seen all across the country, the rollout has just been a disaster this past week. You know, we're seeing areas where literally Oklahoma doesn't have a statewide plan either. They're punting it to the counties. And so you have rural counties with one person health departments being asked to develop a rollout plan for the vaccine. And it's just impossible. You're seeing states where there's no coordination at all. It's really been you're
been
seeing
chaotic.
It's been very chaotic. You're seeing states where upwards of 80% of the vaccine has not been put in people's arms yet because there's simply no plan to getting it from the warehouses where it was, you know, shipped by the federal government to healthcare providers, to patients. And it reminds me a lot of the initial days of the pandemic when there was a severe PPE shortage because, again, there was no coordination. There was no effort to manufacture and provide PPEs that essential workers and healthcare workers needed in order to be safe in their jobs. And this is the same kind of thing where there's just no coordination because the federal government is just washing its hands of the pandemic, even with over 340,000 people dead at this point.
Yeah. So let's just quickly review the phases for Washington State. Washington State has phases that are very similar to the CDC's recommended phases, but they're not real clear, at least not yet. The two phases that everybody kind of knows are phase 1A and 1B. 1A is healthcare workers in high risk positions and first responders, and phase 1B are people living in long-term care and assisted living facilities. And these are the two groups that are currently getting the vaccine right now, and all told, that's about 500,000 people in Washington State. And right now, we just don't have the doses to cover all of them for two shots right now. So, but we're expected to be getting the doses very soon or getting them distributed to start phase two. So the question is then who is in phase two? From what I can tell, that's a much, much larger group, including people who are 65 years old and older who are living at home, people with comorbidities, and people with who are working frontline essential jobs, and that's a broad category. Food and agricultural workers, grocery store workers, U.S. Postal Service workers, and perhaps other delivery workers, manufacturing workers, and others whose, and then this very, very broad category called others whose jobs are critical for society and require them to be on site in close proximity to others. So that
which is an open invitation for companies to lobby to get priority, and we're seeing a lot of that already.
And then there are, and that group may include teachers as well as, you know, many, many, many other workers. Now, there's also the issue of when will the homeless be vaccinated, and what about people who are incarcerated? They're certainly in long-term living situations where they're in close proximity with others. So phase two is an enormous group of people, and it, you know, at the rate that the vaccine is being manufactured and distributed, and the lack of personnel to actually inoculate people and to manage the flow of people
and that's already been a serious
appointments.
Yeah, and the lack of people to administer it has already been a serious problem in states like Arizona.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's one of the big issues. But it's not just the manufacture and delivery of the vaccine, or even the lack of people to schedule appointments and actually administer the vaccine. It's things like lacking enough places with proper cold storage. Large hospitals have it, but many rural hospitals, smaller clinics, and pharmacies lack that.
That's specific to the Pfizer vaccine, though. And one bright spot in all those potential bottlenecks is
which is
that
about
I think
half the vaccine that's going to be made available.
It's a third. Moderna has about twice as much as Pfizer, but we've also got at least three other vaccines that are already in phase three trials, and I think by the end of February those will be available as well. By the time we get through phase one,
yeah,
so
two months from now.
Yeah, so I think we're looking for phase two. We're looking at March. You know, the state has a couple of months to try and clarify what Maria was laying out, all of the very serious ambiguities with who's eligible in phase two. And then we have to get through that very large category, which is probably in Washington State, millions of people, will be available.
Most certainly somewhere between 3 to 6 million people, and it.
Well, there's only 6 million adults in Washington State.
That's what I'm saying.
we also don't have guidance for whether kids should be vaccinated, and if so, when.
They tend to fall in phase three, according to the Washington State plan. Workers in industries that didn't have access to the vaccine under phase two are in phase three, along with young adults and children. So the issue is who's in phase two versus who's in phase three. And there can be arguments made for just about everybody to be in phase two. And then there are some issues that people have with that prioritization. So if, for example, we look at the surge of the coronavirus that started in late October, went through November, and has continued through December, you can look at that as having begun when kids went back to school, and ask yourself if maybe kids shouldn't be vaccinated sooner to keep them from spreading the coronavirus to adults who are more sensitive. So, you know.
And I would add to that that just this morning we got some new data showing that the more contagious British variant that is in the United States now, we've had three confirmed cases, but you know it's much more widespread than that, that kids are much more prone to spreading that than they were the original virus. So that's going to become more of an issue as that variant becomes more widespread and eventually takes over probably by
and
spring.
You know, with that, you know, having arisen in three states, Colorado, California, and Florida, that are so far apart from each other. And
all of those patients have no history of travel. So
exactly.
we know it's community spread in all of those places, at least. And the United States is well down the list of countries that do genetic sequencing. So it hasn't been testing the way it has in the other 32 countries where the variant has been found.
Yeah, and where we had previously thought it had arisen in the UK, it was still isolated to a small section of Britain, the southeast of Britain, and hadn't really spread throughout the country. So my feeling is that it probably originated here in the United States, and then it moved over to Britain and South Africa and has spread from there to other parts of Europe and Asia. I don't think it arose in Britain. I think it arose here. The fact that it's widespread here already would indicate that. And we just, because we haven't been doing genetic testing at the rate that other countries have been of whatever versions people have been getting sick with, I think that's probably, you know, yet another risk of allowing wide community spread and trying to rely on herd immunity as the Trump administration has been doing. But you're right, Job. I mean, there's much the federal government could be doing For example, it could be helping to expand cold storage in rural hospitals and smaller clinics. It could be helping states coordinate by providing them a blueprint of here's how you distribute the vaccine from centralized warehouses. It could be providing the priority for who gets vaccinated first and how to ensure that only the people who are eligible for it receive it. It could
And the President of the United States should be encouraging people to continue to social distance and shut down businesses and wear masks and all of the other basic public mm-hmm. health things that will need to keep being done until a large percentage of the adult population is immunized, which is going to take several months.
Yeah. Now the Trump administration had estimated that at least 20 million people would be vaccinated by December 31st, but only about 3 million have been vaccinated so far. And instead, the 20 million figure is actually the number of COVID-19 cases that we've seen this year in the United States.
Yeah, is we reached 20 million literally on New Year's Eve. So a very grim milestone. And we're close to, well, probably later today, we will get to 350,000 deaths, which is also a very grim milestone.
Yeah. Now, some states like West Virginia are activating their National Guard troops to administer the vaccines, but there are real pitfalls in that. This week, the West Virginia National Guard reported that about 40 people in their state were administered a monoclonal antibody treatment instead of the vaccine that they were supposed to be given. Medical errors like that are one risk behind using non-medical personnel to administer the vaccine and leaving it up to states and local jurisdictions to try to put in place a system like this. Anyone overseeing a program like this has to have checklists and fail-safe procedures in place to avoid medical errors. Having a federal government agency run by public health experts could actually help with this. Instead of allowing states and local governments to reinvent the wheel 50 times over, or, you know, more than 50 times over if you're leaving it to counties like Oklahoma is. And a lot of these state and local public health agencies' jobs, as you pointed out, are short of money and way overstretched currently because they're dealing with the actual pandemic.
And they've been in emergency mode for several months now, and people are exhausted, and they're leaving the profession. Mm-hmm. And we're losing institutional knowledge about how these health departments work. So there's so many levels at which the lack of federal support for state and local governments has just been critical. There's been funding issues with these health departments as well, which have been traditionally one of the first areas, public health, that conservative legislatures try to cut when they have to make budgets balance. And we're seeing what the lack of investment in public health, not just over the past year, but for the last couple of generations, has done to decimate those departments in a crisis. We simply don't have the capacity to respond competently to that. Even if you had, competent messaging and guidance from the federal government, you would still need a massive infusion of support. And of course, with this latest bill that Congress passed last week, there will be a little bit of help forthcoming, but it's not nearly adequate to the challenges they're facing.
And it's earmarked for vaccine distribution. It's really not earmarked specifically for helping states with their rollout plans or for helping states, call in retired medical personnel and or military medics to staff vaccine clinics or to really help them figure out, how do you avoid medical errors while you're doing this?
Yeah, and because of the because of the economic fallout from the pandemic and the requirement at the state level that they balance their budgets, you're not going to see the kind of investment in either economic support for people impacted by the pandemic or support for healthcare and things like the vaccine rollout at the state and local level because they just don't have the money. Mm-hmm. Instead, you're going to be seeing layoffs of public employees, and you're going to be seeing a world of hurt in terms of budget cuts to social safety net programs that are needed now more than ever.
Yeah. Now, also this week, in the first major act against vaccination, a Wisconsin pharmacist deliberately spoiled 570 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine at the Aurora Medical Center in Grafton, Wisconsin, which is a small community of about 12,000 people. A hospital pharmacist removed 57 vials of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine from a hospital refrigerator and intentionally left them out overnight, knowing that they would spoil after 12 hours without refrigeration. Each vial contains about 10 doses of the vaccine. Of course, the pharmacist was immediately fired. But
And is being criminally charged with adulteration of a prescription drug.
Yeah, and first degree recklessly endangering safety, as well as property damage. On that same day in Wisconsin, 42 people died and 3,810 more people were diagnosed with COVID-19. So I don't think that will be the only instance we're going to see, but it kind of points up too that there are real consequences when you have a president who ignores science and supports things like questioning the efficacy of vaccines.
And we're seeing also a number of healthcare providers in places like Southern California refusing to take the shot.
Yeah. So what do you do in that situation? It would also help if the feds would come out and say, look, as healthcare workers, you're required, and give employers the power to say, look, if you don't take the vaccination, you have to have a valid medical reason. And if you don't have a valid medical reason, you can't work for us anymore.
Yeah. And same thing for airlines and air travel.
Yeah.
You can't get on a plane, or you can't go work at your employer if you don't haven't been vaccinated.
Yeah.
And haven't had proof of it.
Speaking of airplanes, in spite of a call by the CDC for people to not travel and gather this holiday season,
oh God,
millions passed through airports in the last 2 weeks, many of them coughing, vomiting, and or not wearing masks. The Transportation Safety Administration says that 10.2 million people went through U.S. airports in the last 10 days of 2020, an average of about 1 million people per day, and about 44% of the number who flew last year in that same time period. Dozens of passengers refused to wear masks, and when confronted, they would brandish drinking cups or bags of food as their excuse for not wearing a mask throughout an entire flight. This included some passengers who were coughing while not wearing masks, and some who insisted that the pandemic is a massive hoax. Others boarded airplanes while feverish and obviously sick. Airline workers cited the problem of not having adequate security to enforce mask wearing and allowing passengers to remove their masks to eat or drink. Now, a federal moratorium on eating or drinking on flights would take care of this, but the Trump administration has refused to issue one. The Federal Department of Transportation rejected a petition in October to require that masks be worn at all times on airplanes, subways, and other forms of transportation, leaving it up to local jurisdictions to decide. But of course, local jurisdictions like states and cities don't have control over airplane flights, and aviation safety is the responsibility of the Federal Aviation Administration, which is under the Federal Department of Transportation. This has left mask mandates the province of airline companies, which are operating in the red and don't have the money to employ security personnel to enforce mask wearing. They also don't have an incentive to kick people off of flights unless their behavior is very, very egregious. And it seems to be happening somewhat, but only on a case-by-case basis. It's not standardized. So if we see a virus surge this January because of the 10.2 million people who traveled on airlines.
I would correct that when, not if.
Yeah, that's going to be why. And yet another place where the Trump administration has failed to ensure the safety of Americans under the pandemic.
And I think we're going to see those higher numbers starting this coming week with people who traveled before Christmas.
Yeah.
And it's just going to get worse over the month. It's going to be a very, very rough month for the pandemic.
I think so.
And speaking of higher numbers, one thing we haven't mentioned, which I know we all already know to a degree, this entire healthcare system of ours is built on an infrastructure of private healthcare facilities, basically, for-profit mm-hmm. healthcare facilities, that in terms of higher numbers, we haven't seen, we just finished a quarter and we won't see the profit numbers coming out for, what, another month or so, Maria?
At least.
But we know from the quarter before that, that the really big healthcare entities were making record profits during this entire scam.
So none of that's
going into protecting the people that work there. None of it is going into buying more equipment and facilities and protective gear for the people there. It's going into CEOs and board members' pockets.
And I would add to that that the Affordable Care Act social safety net, which has worked, and we saw record enrollment this past month, but there is still a case pending before the Supreme Court that it will decide sometime in the next 6 months that could abolish all of that and leave health insurance companies free to deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, which is already about 100 million people in this country. But if they decide also that having been tested positive for COVID constitutes a pre-existing condition, I would expect that would happen. That's going to throw tens of millions more people by the time we're done with this being unable to get health insurance at all. That's going to be a real problem, a serious problem. I was trying to describe the United States healthcare system to somebody in Australia, which, as with most industrialized countries, has universal healthcare. And I likened it to, for 70 years, they've been erecting scaffolding around this place on the earth, and now they're calling it a building. And it's not. It's just this elaborate, improvised and added on to and added on to and added on to system that makes no systemic institutional sense. You've got middle people at every level siphoning off profits. You've got, it's not designed to maximize the health of the general population. It's a mess, and everybody knows it. But that is a political issue, and it's going to be a huge question for Congress and the Biden administration coming in.
Yeah, yeah. And that, I think, takes us into our top national stories of 2020.
The underreported stories?
Yeah, the underreported.
There's a lot of them.
Last week we did the underreported local stories. This week we're doing the underreported or top national stories of 2020.
And there were so many big stories in 2020 that it buried a lot of other stories.
Oh, yeah.
That are also critical.
At the top of my list is this second COVID-19 relief bill that Trump just gave in and signed was originally proposed back in July. So it's taken 6 months for Donald Trump and the Republicans to decide that they will actually pass a second COVID-19 relief bill. And that they'll vote for more COVID-19 relief. In the meantime, the number of people who are suffering from homelessness and hunger is skyrocketing. Here in our own state, we've seen approximately a doubling of people who need food assistance, emergency food assistance. And that's just gonna increase massively in the coming year. So that's number one at the top of my list. The Republicans
the Democratic-controlled House passed a second relief bill back in May. So the 6 months, actually, there was a couple months in there where they were negotiating in between that also. So, you know, as much as we saw a laudable series of actions by Congress in the first month of the pandemic to try and get relief to people, it absolutely stalled at that point. And 100% of that stalling was due to Republican intransigence.
Mm-hmm. Number two on my list is nothing proves Donald Trump's stupidity more than the term anarchist jurisdiction. Right?
It's an oxymoron.
That, I think, was the highlight of dumb Trump utterances this year for me. And, you know, it wasn't just a Twitter fart. He actually tried to turn that into policy. In the middle of the year, Trump instructed Russell Vought, the acting director of the Office of Management and Budget, and Attorney General William Barr, to identify Democratic-controlled cities and states that he could label anarchist jurisdictions with the goal of denying them federal funding. Illegal.
Barr tried to turn that idiotic phrase into a legal term, which is even worse.
Yeah. Trump named his preferred candidates, four cities: Portland, Seattle, New York City, and Washington, D.C. And I want to point out that those last two on the list are his own cities. He's from New York City and currently resides in Washington, D.C., right? So he was trying to name those two cities, one that he's from and one where he is quote unquote ruling, as anarchist jurisdictions. Now, in late October, Seattle, Portland, and New York City banded together and sued the Trump administration over the anarchist jurisdiction declaration. Through that lawsuit, they've been able to halt Trump's unconstitutional threat to overrule Congress's power of the purse. Otherwise, I think we all would have wanted to ignore what seemed like a really dumb joke, except that it really wasn't a joke. It was just dumb.
Yeah, and we also saw one of the interesting things that was slipped into the National Defense Authorization Act that was passed this past week, and this is one of my underreported stories of why Trump vetoed the defense spending bill, which is never done, right? And Congress has overridden that veto. But there were several provisions, because it's a huge bill, defense spending, because it's an essential bill, Congress people tend to attach their own legislation that hasn't passed during the course of the congressional session into that bill. So there were several things that were really important. One of them is language that will repeat prevent a repeat of the debacle that happened in Lafayette Square this past summer, where Trump mobilized executive branch law enforcement people to basically attack peaceful protesters so they could have a photo op in Lafayette Square. It was a very notorious incident, and it was really a turning point in the federal government's handling of those protests. And there's language now saying that military personnel, law enforcement personnel, cannot be used for that kind of purpose. But there's other provisions that were really the reason, I think, that Trump vetoed that. And this is another underreported story, that that number one, it's not about the Confederate bases. That's just red meat for his racist base, right? But there is a very strong new set of laws trying to control money laundering from dirty Russian money, for random example. This was a separate bill that was passed in 2020 and then folded into the defense spending bill. There's also an expansion of the powers of CISA, the cybersecurity agency, whose head Christopher Krebs Trump fired in November after Krebs said that had been a secure election. This is an agency that is intended to try and prevent exactly this sort of foreign interference online in social media and in disinformation campaigns that Trump relied upon in 2016 in order to get elected and tried to rely upon in 2020. He's considering a run in 2024 and doesn't want that avenue of support closed to him, because he probably couldn't get elected without it, honestly. So there were all these different provisions that directly challenged Trump that Republicans in both the House and the Senate supported, both in the original vote and in the override vote. So you're seeing something of a split now in the Republican Party between people who will do whatever Trump tells them to and people who are starting to assert some independence from the crazy.
Yeah. Now, lest we reward or praise the Republicans too much, let's remember that early in the year, Republicans chose Donald Trump over the Constitution when they voted against impeachment articles in February. All the Democrats in the Senate voted yes on the obstruction of Congress charge, and all Republicans voted no. And then they did it a second time with a no vote on the abuse of power charge, except for one Republican, Mitt Romney, who voted yes. And but get this, the Republicans in the Senate admitted at the time that Trump was guilty, but they shirked their responsibility to remove him from office, saying they wanted to leave it to voters to do their dirty work. So then we had to suffer through another almost full year of having him attempt to run the country.
With the knowledge that he would not be held accountable for anything that he did.
Yeah, exactly. And it reinforced his feeling that he could get away with anything.
And I would add to that, you know, quite aside from the merits of the actual articles of impeachment, and it was very clear he was guilty of those. Mm-hmm. That was proven
well beyond
a doubt. And the
Republicans even said so.
Yeah,
they even said at the time.
But beyond that, we also knew at the time that Trump would try to downplay, minimize the pandemic, and that it would cost potentially at the time millions of lives. And we're starting to see that come true. And Republicans knew it at the time. They got confidential briefings in late January about how serious the pandemic posed a threat for the country.
And they could have weighed that against what kind of president do we have? You know, would he be a good one in an emergency like this? And they chose Donald Trump.
And he is already downplaying the virus at that point. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but their response was to turn around in some cases in the Senate and do insider trading. And the insider trading scandal started to get a bit more attention and get at the end of the year because both of the senators up for reelection in Georgia in the runoff next week were involved in that. You had several Republican senators who went from that briefing and promptly either dumped stocks that they knew would be affected, like airlines and hotels, or bought stocks.
Healthcare
stocks, you know, Amazon stocks, et cetera. So that was their response, was to try and cash in. It wasn't to try and do anything responsible to head off the pandemic. And it certainly wasn't to try and hold accountable a president that they knew would have an incompetent response to it.
Mm-hmm. So in that case, they chose Donald Trump over the health and welfare of the American people.
And not only they chose Trump, but they chose their own political careers over the Constitution that they were sworn to protect and the health and well-being of their constituents because they were afraid of getting primaried on the right if they didn't support Trump completely. So it was in the end a very selfish vote.
Yeah. And then fourth on my list is Antifa is not a movement or an organization. Anti-fascism is a philosophy that most people share, except for Trump supporters. I think in a year when political violence really surged in the United States, the mainstream media missed that story that most of the physical violence was committed by police and right-wing militia groups, while left-wing demonstrators committed some property damage for the most part. And it was the property damage that stole the headlines, not the real physical violence. And as usual, there was no meaningful discussion of why people were protesting in the streets or whether the principles they were pushing for are ones that we all share, like racial equality, income equality, and democracy, because I think it's pretty clear that the folks in the street who support Donald Trump, the right-wing militia groups, obviously don't share those values.
Yeah, and we're seeing with the election fallout, too. I would also add to that that another underreported story that at the local level in a number of areas, there were significant victories won by that protest movement in terms of cuts to police budgets.
At least that's true here in Seattle. Yeah.
Well, in a number of other cities as well, Minneapolis, Louisville, even, New York City, San Francisco.
But, or even here in King County with the charter amendments.
Sure.
On the King County Sheriff's.
And that vote, for example, was not framed as a win for the police accountability movement. It was framed as, well, that was, you know, just something on the ballot. but the protesters didn't get credit for their victories. At the same time, local jurisdictions also made a ton of promises, that were simply not kept. And that has not been a story either. For example, in Minneapolis, the first response after a week of riots in the wake of George Floyd's murder was, we need to figure out ways to abolish the Minneapolis Police Department. Well, that effort has by and large stalled. Meantime, we had another police killing of a black man, this past week in Minneapolis. So we're seeing that kind of backtracking, once the street heat has kind of dissipated with the winter months. So I think that movement is not going away. It still has a lot of work to do in 2021 and a lot of people willing to do that work.
Yeah, agreed. And then number five on my list, courts at all levels overturned Trump's racist anti-immigration policies. And a lot of these judges were judges that were appointed by Donald Trump or by George W. Bush before him. And we can't really call them, and I want to point out too, we can't really call them immigration policies, which is what the mainstream media calls them, because they're manifestly anti-immigrant, and especially anti-black and anti-brown immigrants. This includes the child separation policy, which this year we discovered really began shortly after Trump was elected. And that policy was used to kidnap over 5,500 children at the southern border with Mexico, that we know of. Courts forced the Trump administration to return about 5,000 of those kids, but another 500 still remain in custody. And it's going to be up to the Biden administration to try to find the parents of those kids. Although I should point out the parents may have been killed when they were deported back to their home countries. Most of the families that left their home countries to seek asylum here do it for reasons of security because there's too much violence or they've had a credible threat of violence from a local gang.
And I would add a couple of other underreported pieces of that story. One, that a number of people who have been deported to their home country have in fact been killed. So they were having, and there's been no systematic accounting of that. We've just gotten anecdotal stories, but there have been a lot of them. And so the people were fleeing their countries for good reasons. They were fleeing for their lives and they came to the United States, which is traditionally, granted asylum in those kind of cases. And this time they were thrown back to their deaths.
That is true. And we probably should do a study to try to figure out how many, although that would be a massive effort, I think, because of the hundreds of thousands of people who have been automatically denied asylum and returned to their home countries by the Trump administration. Courts have also ruled against Trump on his anti-asylum policies. They ruled to restore the DACA program this year, and they ruled that Donald Trump's acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, one of his many acting cabinet members, was illegally appointed to that position among, you know, many of the other dubious Trump appointments. So in many, many cases, judges and even the most conservative of judges have ruled against Donald Trump and Stephen Miller's anti-immigration policies.
And in many, many cases, the Trump administration has simply ignored those court rulings. And that's been a problem, too. Chad Wolf is still in power, even though he was appointed illegally, for example. Another court filing that we got just in December, this is regarding the child separation policy, was that the Trump administration had been sitting on addresses and phone numbers of the family members of the kids that they were supposed to be trying to reunite with their families, and had not given that information, that they had that information, to the courts. This is unconscionable. This is they had the information. In some cases, they had the phone numbers of where the parents were, and they simply didn't provide it. It just
yeah, it's inexcusable. Yeah, and I think there are some folks there who need to be charged with a lawsuit, and maybe need to go to prison.
I think there we're going to find out. Once the Biden administration comes in, we're going to find out from records, the ones that weren't shredded or the hard drives that weren't wiped, that the scandals we know and the criminality that we know from the Trump administration right now is just the tip of the iceberg.
Probably.
There's a lot, much, much more that has been done over the last 4 years that, that deserves prison sentences.
Yeah, and I'm going to just skip to number 7 on my list, which is Donald Trump had so many scandals in his cabinet, barely a single cabinet agency is unscathed. And let's just list some of the cabinet secretaries who have been subjects of scandals. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Energy Secretary Rick Perry, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, Labor Secretary Alex Acosta, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price, Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, you can slow me down if you want, Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin, Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson, and those are just the cabinet secretaries. I might have missed a couple. And then there were the advisors closer to Trump, including his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, Foreign Policy Advisor George Papadopoulos, National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter, his former campaign manager Paul Manafort, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, even his own daughter, Ivanka Trump, was caught using a personal email account to conduct government business, doing exactly what Donald Trump had excoriated Hillary Clinton for doing. And Jared Kushner, I would
add to that those scandals and that criminality is still ongoing. Just this past week, we saw an inspector general who was investigating Elaine Chao, who's the Secretary of Transportation, for corruption. And that IG was fired by Trump. Now, Elaine Chao was also a cabinet secretary for George W. Bush. She was the labor secretary. She doesn't have any experience in either labor or transportation, but she is married to Mitch McConnell. So that's what's going on there.
So, you know, that list is so long that in September of 2019, well over a year ago, CNN ran an article with the headline, quote, "It's nearly impossible to track all the scandals swirling around Trump," end quote. And that is true. It's nearly impossible. And I think historians are going to have a huge job trying to dig through records and figure out if there were any clean people in the Trump administration. So really, it's no wonder that Donald Trump has such a long, long list of pardons to issue. And my guess is he's not going to be able to get through all of them before the inauguration.
No. And again, the tone for that starts at the top.
Oh, yes.
Trump surrounded himself with people who he could relate to, people who were just as venal, just as corrupt as he is. And he set a tone for that.
Yeah.
And you can see what the result was through all 4 years. And, you know, once he was acquitted in the impeachment trial and it was clear that he was not going to be held accountable for anything, it just got worse in this past year, even after that CNN headline.
Yeah. And then also on my list was, and I think we mentioned this earlier, 2020 was the year when we saw that two things shouldn't be tied to market forces. And those are healthcare and housing. I think the convergence of the pandemic plus the increase, massive increase in income inequality in 2020 were a perfect storm to create a wave of over 300,000 people dead from COVID-19. And an oncoming wave of homeless people once federal, state, and local eviction moratoria expire. as well as a massive increase in the number of people who are going hungry. And that includes a lot of children in family households that are suffering from hunger and massive income inequality.
One in four children.
Oh, yeah. I think the best way to address this would be to remove the profit motive from healthcare and low-income housing, to implement a true public healthcare system like Medicare for All, which Joe Biden has said that he doesn't support, and to provide more money and support for public housing at the federal level, to starting at the federal level. And I just don't know that he supports that either. Although there are a lot of people in the United States who think Medicare for All is a great idea, and you could argue that a majority of Americans, when they really understand what it means, support it. So I think those are two big things that we're going to see a lot more support for and maybe a bigger push for as the Biden administration takes office.
Yeah, and as people start to you know, analyze what went wrong in the pandemic,
yeah,
the social safety net and the need for affordable health care for everybody are going to be near the top of that list.
Yeah. So you had some more items on your list.
Yeah. We had a story that was a big story for about two news cycles, and then it disappeared, which was the New York Times got a hold of 10 years of Donald Trump's tax returns, and they showed an ongoing pattern of criminality. And once again, that is part of the basis for the current state and local investigations of Trump and the Trump Organization, that he cannot head off with pardons before he leaves office. He's going to have significant legal exposures once he becomes a private citizen. And I think that's going to be a major story in 2021, whether either the feds or the Manhattan DA or any other local authorities choose to prosecute Donald Trump personally for any of that criminality, which is a matter of public record right now in terms of tax evasion, in terms of money laundering, in terms of all kinds of shady financial dealings.
He also has a bunch of loans coming due, too, in the coming year to 2 years. So we'll see, too, if he manages to avoid bankruptcy.
Yeah. One of the other things that I had on my list, once it became obvious about late September or so that Donald Trump was at significant risk of losing the election, you have seen a concerted effort by a number of federal agencies to deregulate as much as they can going out the door. And the damage, particularly to the environment, has been historic. Now, some of it has been headed off by the courts. Some of it, interestingly, has been headed off by the markets. For example, the Trump administration's effort to sell oil leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge has gone wanting for a lack of buyers among the energy companies. But you certainly had a concerted effort to try and, you know, destroy as much of the federal regulatory apparatus as they could before they left office. And that that was an effort that obviously has gone on for 4 years, but it ramped up a great deal this past fall, and that has not gotten a lot of media attention at all.
Yeah, I think because there was just so much of it going on.
Yeah,
it was hard to find room to report.
And that is something that Trump has set a successful precedent for, is he really showed that the best way to avoid media coverage of scandals is just to have so many of them that the media can't keep up. And they can't focus on any one thing, because by the time they get a hold of one thing, the administration is on to the next five things. So that unfortunately, I think is something, a pattern that we're going to see repeated by, you know, smarter leaders in the future, unfortunately.
Well, with that, we are out of time. So we,
Happy New Year. Happy New Year. Getting off to the right start.
Yeah.
And, looking forward to, seeing what you both have to share, the same time next week.
Absolutely. We'll be back.
Yes, I'll be here.
With more happy news.
Uh huh. All right.